Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. In 30 minutes, we go beyond the headlines with sharp insights and expert analysis from the leaders and decision makers shaping our future. So whether you're tuning in live or catching us later, stay ahead with some of the stories that really matter. Coming up on the program today, climate at a crossroads. Can the Paris Agreement deliver a sustainable future? We have an extended interview with global climate expert Sir David King. The SA Agulhas returns with chilling findings from Antarctica. Africa's energy puzzle, can the continent achieve a sustainable mix? And fixing the system, is this the moment for real public service reform? It's Thursday, March the 6th. Now, I think it's fair to say, in fact, probably obvious, that the world's climate crisis is now at a tipping point, and the Paris Agreement faces new challenges as nations struggle to meet their commitments. So what needs to change to ensure a sustainable future, and is global leadership failing us? As part of Wits University's G20 Sustainability Series, Sir David King, Chair of the Climate Crisis Advisory Group, is in South Africa and offering a critical perspective on the way forward and joins us on the program now. Professor King, thank you very much indeed. You've argued for decades that climate change is the greatest challenge facing human beings. Do you think we've moved beyond something which could be a salvageable point, or do you still have some hope?
We should certainly not give up hope. We are in a very dangerous situation. It does look as if the tipping point is very, very close with us. We know that Greenland is now, for example, losing ice at the rate of about 50 billion tons every hour. And what this means is that sea levels rising rapidly, much more rapidly in the past, could rise by meters in the coming decades. Now, this is a scare story, but we've just got to take note of the fact that if we look at the worst risk outcome, it means that we, the human race, really are under threat to manage our future. It's so important that we now focus on how to deliver the response. And of course, with the election of Trump in the White House and his withdrawal from the Paris Agreement made in 2015, we appear to be in a much more challenging situation. And my interpretation of that is the response from nations who understand the nature of the threat to Trump's withdrawal has to be to take leadership. And I'm here in South Africa to say South Africa, in Africa and beyond, can play a strong leadership role. Not only is South Africa now in the presidency of G20, but we can, by making commitments, and the British Prime Minister has made a commitment to reduce emissions by 81% by 2035. If we can make commitments like that, going way beyond commitments made in 2015, then we have a good chance of a manageable future.
It's all about leadership, as you suggest, but my question then is, are global leaders genuinely committed to radical climate action, or is there a fundamental failure still in accountability and broader governance?
It's astonishing to say that global leaders have taken their eyes off this one. But of course, we all know the war in the Ukraine, the situation in the world globally is not looking very attractive, and leaders have got their focus on other issues. But nevertheless, it is important to say that the British Prime Minister's leadership position is not unique. China, for example, the Climate Crisis Advisory Group that I chair has produced a very detailed report on what China is doing to shift away from fossil fuels. They have the same challenge as South Africa, which is their strong dependence historically on coal, locally produced coal. But nevertheless, China is committing itself to not only get to net zero, but to move very quickly to a situation where they electrify all of their energy needs, including road transport, and they're already managing that at an astonishing rate, but also to shift across to seeing that all of their electricity production is not from use of fossil fuels. Now, China's playing a strong leadership role, but in the background. They have declared very clearly that they do not want to be seen as the next global hegemon after the United States. But shift along with the leadership shown by China, the United Kingdom, the European Union, Brazil, Indonesia, Kenya. There are a range of countries that are lining up to commit themselves to going way beyond their commitments made in 2015 in response to Trump's withdrawal.
Professor King, let me continue on the coal argument that you raise, and let me bring it back to South Africa. Obviously, a huge reliance on coal. As far as this country or this region is concerned, can a just transition to renewable energy, in your opinion, be achieved without fundamental economic devastation? That is a popular argument.
Yes, well, I can say without any doubt at all that the transition to renewable energy for South Africa is one that will grow your economy. It's not an economic threat at all. The British are very surprised to be able to say that we discovered offshore wind, which apparently has seemed to be the most expensive way to make electricity, but we need it as an island nation. Offshore wind for the UK is now the cheapest form of electricity we could produce. It is cheaper than fossil fuel production. What we really need to understand is the whole world is facing a future of renewable energy systems which are much cheaper to produce than the previous fossil fuel base. So I think we can honestly say to South Africa, if you can transition the coal miners away from working in coal, if you can transition those dependent on those coal miners away from coal and do it quickly and transition your energy systems to what South Africa has in abundance, solar and wind, you will create a future in which economy grows. It's important to say this. China now has over 50% of new car sales are electric. And those electric cars being produced in China are leading the way globally. And of course, most car manufacturers are now producing electric vehicles. If you charge your car overnight, and you charge it when electricity demand is low, you can produce energy in your car at a cost that is considerably lower than petrol or diesel. So there are real advantages in economics in making this transition. I do believe that South Africa needs to leap forward and grab the opportunity. So, for example, your electricity demand is potentially in the region of 45 gigawatts. And what you need to understand is that because the coal mines, but also the coal production facilities are really aging and demanding a large amount of maintenance, you're not able to produce anything like that amount of electricity around the clock. And so you have an opportunity to introduce renewables at scale, and Eskom itself should be involved in that, at scale while you're still dealing with the transition for the coal mining community. So I think there's no need to wait. You've got a big gap in electricity production. That gap is causing blackouts, which are not good for economic growth. And do this as quickly as possible.
Professor King, you'll concede, though, that there is a political argument here as well. The coal reliance debate in South Africa is a contentious one, and there are lots of naysayers.
Of course, it's a contentious issue, and I fully understand that. And I'm sure that the president also fully understands that. But the contention should not be such that your economic growth continues to suffer. There's little doubt in my mind and in the minds of many others that that is what is causing the economic growth to slow down in South Africa. So I do think this nettle has to be grasped, and the way to grasp it really is to, for example, get engaged with the Chinese government and those involved in China in the energy transition, because they're faced with a very, very similar challenge. And just looking at best practice, I would say that is coming from China today. It's not a bad place to seek advice and take that advice, but don't delay. I'd say get on with it.
Professor King, if I can ask you one more question in conclusion, and let me pivot slightly. Many developing countries argue they shouldn't bear the same climate burdens as wealthier nations. Do you think this is a fair argument?
Of course it's a fair argument. And then we're faced with the fact that the most wealthy country in the world, the United States, is totally withdrawing from the situation. And so I started by saying the challenge now is for the rest of the world to take the leadership that they have been looking to the United States. And to be honest, the United States has never taken a leadership position on this situation. We have now got the United States with gloves off. And that bare-fisted, bare-knuckle approach is one which also reveals the position of the United States and the power of the fossil fuel lobby in that country. And that lobby is internationally very, very successful. What we need to understand is not only the power of that lobby, but now every nation has to face up to this as a reality that they're facing. Mm-hmm. South Africa is like every other part of the world, going to continue to suffer, and that suffering will increase as we continue to put more greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. We're really at that tipping point today.
Sir David King, Chair of the Climate Crisis Advisory Group, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, the S.A. Agalas II has just returned from its latest Antarctic expedition, bringing back some worrying findings about the state of the ice and the Southern Ocean in particular. Now, with climate change accelerating, these discoveries, I imagine, could have serious implications for global sea levels and weather patterns. I'm joined now by Dr. Ashley Johnson, Director of Oceans Research at the Department of Forestry, Fisheries and the Environment. Dr. Johnson, a very warm welcome to you. Let's start with the big picture. What are these alarming discoveries that have emerged after the return of the ship?
The issues that we are interested in, particularly in the Antarctic, is around the biodiversity, as well as the work that we do with a lot of partner countries and partner institutions. And some of the findings that we've discovered is that there are areas of the ice that is thinning. And it's thinning because that ice is now interacting with water that is warmer than what it usually is. So what that means then is that once ice melts, that is not on the continent, it is that adds to sea level. So those are some of the findings we have. We're finding that there are areas whereby absorption of carbon from the atmosphere into the ocean has increased, hence ocean acidification. So those are the kinds of things that we are tracking in the Southern Ocean.
And all of this is very worrying, Dr. Johnson, because as you and I are having this conversation, I'm also reading today that the world's biggest iceberg appears to have run aground around 70 kilometers from an island in Antarctica. And apart from the wildlife issue, it also is an indicator of the growing climate crisis that we're facing.
Absolutely. You see, if more ice breaks, the issue around ice breakage is whether the ice is in the ocean or not in the ocean. Because once it's in the ocean, the water level has already been compensated for, known generally as an Archimedes principle. It is when the ice that is on land melts, that then adds water to the sea level. So those are the kinds of things that we need to be very, very careful of when we talk about climate and climate change. But big chunks of ice breaking from Antarctica is not an unusual phenomenon, but it seems to be happening a little bit more frequently than before. And that is what we are concerned about.
And Dr. Johnson, does this necessarily indicate then a faster than expected rise in sea levels?
Well, this is the issue that we're trying to understand, because when you look at the dynamic of the Antarctic continent itself, on one side of the continent, you'll find that ice is thinning, but then it's thickening on the other side. So the issue of understanding climate and climate change is not a simple one, it's a complex one. And it is about the trend over time that we are looking at. So when we're tracking what is happening to sea level, you might find that in some areas it's up, in other areas it's down, in other areas it's remained the same. So what the global community is doing, including South Africa, is then trying to see what are the trends in sea level in general across the world, as well as around the Antarctic, because that would dictate whether the trend is moving upwards or whether it's staying the same. However, in the main, sea level rise is a huge concern, particularly because of particularly melting ice on Greenland, which is ice on land that's being added to the ocean and the sea level, and similarly within the Antarctic.
Critical, as you say, that all of this is studied through the prism of a trend line. So are you able to throw any light for me on how findings in the here and now compare to previous research on the ice melt in Antarctic and ocean changes?
Well, the ideas that we've punted now, particularly knowing that there's about 20 countries that's doing research work in the Antarctic, and we are now collating all of that information as part of a global effort. What we've seen to this point in time is that there does seem to be some melt, a net loss in Antarctica. However, that trend has not been finalized, and it's not, we don't want to be alarmists unnecessarily. So you can understand that from an Antarctic research perspective, we want to be absolutely sure what that trend line is doing. At the moment, it appears to be that way, but we don't know, because again, you're looking at millennial changes. It's not something that happens on a year-to-year basis, if you understand what I mean.
Just a final one then, Dr. Johnson. How should we be wrapping our minds around either intervention or solutions that need to be immediately prioritized, with the caveat that this is a long-term issue and we can't jump to conclusions or, as you say, be alarmist?
Well, I think the world needs to recognize that what we have been doing in terms of industrialization is not helping, and we are continuing on that trend. And again, this is not something that a country can do, but this is what a world can do as a whole. So we would fully support issues like reducing carbon emissions into the atmosphere. We would, even simple things like recycling, managing waste, protecting biodiversity, respecting the environment as a whole, that meaning ocean, atmosphere, and your terrestrial environment. That's it at a very simple level. The less use of things that cannot be reused, like plastics. Get to that point in our history whereby we start recognizing that we are part of the environment and not outside of the environment. And I think it's a mindset change that needs to happen, not only within governments, but in the ordinary citizen as well.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Dr. Ashley Johnson, Director of Oceans Research at the Department of Forestry, Fisheries and the Environment.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
The Africa Energy Indaba is ongoing in Cape Town this week, bringing together high-level representatives from African governments, the private sector, as well as key funding institutions. It is, though, a very different landscape to what delegates experienced this time last year. Apart from the gains in reducing load shedding, it's mostly because of the dramatic shift in geopolitics brought on by sweeping policy changes from the Trump administration that is garnering much attention. And this is all going to have some kind of impact impact on Africa's energy transition, as well as the availability of funding for projects aimed at ultimately achieving net zero. Andrew Maggs of Africa Mining Watch is at the event. Andrew, a very warm welcome. The Minister of Energy and Electricity, Josienso Ramakgopa, opening the conference. What was his key message?
As alluded to in your introduction, the minister was quick to make reference to the new realities shaped by geopolitics. Africa's energy transition will be more difficult, costly, and complicated than expected, meaning it's time to rethink priorities, policies, and investments. The minister spoke of multilateral cooperation being under strain and the weaponizing of trade having an adverse effect on growth and development in Africa. And the shift in geopolitics is, of course, driven by the new U.S. administration. It's estimated that the decision by the U.S. government to withdraw from the Paris Agreement will result in a loss of some $8 billion in funding globally for energy transition. Also, there'll be consequences from President Trump's decision to terminate the U.S. government's Power Africa initiative. This was established back in 2013, the goal of which was to add at least 30,000 megawatts of generation capacity and install 60 million new electricity connections in Africa by 2030. The minister also spoke of the necessity for Africa to fully exploit renewable resources. Africa holds 60% of the world's best solar resources, but has installed only 1% of global solar PV capacity. There's also a significant opportunity to ramp up mining of Africa's green metals, which are utilized in clean energy applications. For example, cobalt, copper, and lithium, which is used in batteries for electric vehicles. And in turn, that provides an opportunity to expand the manufacturing base by beneficiating these minerals as opposed to shipping them out to export markets as bulk materials.
Andrew, let's look at the diplomatic side of all of this. Given South Africa's position as the head of the G20 this year, did the minister in any way articulate on how government can or should maximize this opportunity?
Yes, the minister spoke of the imperative for South Africa to maximize the opportunity as head of the G20. This means, to use his terminology, exercising energy diplomacy and pragmatism. And I think we'll see this coming through in the work of the various G20 technical working groups, one of which is the Sustainable Finance Working Group. This group is tasked with identifying institutional and market barriers to sustainable finance, developing options to overcome these barriers, and contributing in an improved alignment of the international financial system to the objectives of the 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development and the Paris Agreement. The minister also spoke of continuing the work of Brazil, the previous G20 head. Brazil made significant progress in advocating a reduction in the use of wood fuels in cooking. Remember, in Africa, 1 billion people still rely on biomass for cooking.
Ultimately, I think all of this comes down to money. Any requirements to fund the energy transition under discussion? In other words, where's the money going to come from?
When one looks at the funding requirements to transition, you can appreciate the scale of the challenge. The continent faces a financing requirement in the region of $2.7 trillion by 2030. That's around about $400 billion annually. We've seen, though, an increase in climate finance inflows over the past few years, with Africa's annual climate investment crossing the $50 billion mark for the first time in 2022. Of concern, though, is that climate finance continues to remain concentrated in a handful of Africa's 54 countries. 10 countries account for 50% of Africa's total climate finance flows. Another 30 countries receive 10% between them. In terms of sources of funding, currently public sources provide just over 80% of Africa's climate finance. Multilateral DFIs, for example, World Bank, African Development Bank, and bilateral agencies are contributing 76% of those flows. private flows are in the region of 8 billion. In global terms, that's a drop in the ocean. It represents 3.5% of global FDI in climate change funding. Let me just add, in Minister Ramaphosa's opinion, the single biggest impediment is the cost of capital in Africa. Real and perceived risk drives up the cost of capital and arguably skewed and biased credit ratings as well.
All right, I'm going to leave it there, updating you on the Africa Energy Indaba. Andrew Maggs of Africa Mining Watch, thank you very much indeed.
Top stories to keep your eyes and ears on.
Now, South Africa's public service is at something of a crossroads, and as calls for reform grow louder, the focus is on making government more effective, more accountable, and I guess more professional. But here's my question. How do we go beyond policy and actually fix the system? Well, one person who's leading the charge is Yoliswa Makasi, head of the Public Service Reform Program at the New South Institute. Yoliswa, a very warm welcome to you. Why do you think this is such a crucial moment for public reform or public service reform in South Africa? Why now?
Well, public service reform in South Africa is a crucial moment because at the core of public service reform is ensuring that citizens do get quality services, which is what the public service is about, to ensure that the citizens of the country are being served. So from that point of view, it's important that we continue to talk about these reforms and to ensure that the reforms do take place as we observe that there seemingly is a decline in terms of provision of public services. But also it's to continuously remind public servants that they have a responsibility to serve. The ethos of public administration is about serving, and we have to live up to that responsibility.
When you talk about a decline in public service delivery, do you think it's getting worse?
Well, I mean, judging by the challenges that are seemingly being reported from a service delivery point of view, I think that there is a sense that it's getting worse. I have not done any specific study to qualify that, but from my experience and from seeing some of the activities that take place, it seems that there is really a concern and it needs to be given attention. So from that point of view, we need to really put all our hands on the deck and ensure that we support government in handling these particular matters.
Yoliswa, it's a big job. Where do you start?
Well, at the NSI, the NSI is a policy institute, and therefore their biggest responsibility is to do research, is to guide and is to advise government, engage society broadly. So our first point of contact is work that's already on the pipeline in terms of what government is doing. There is a legislation that is being amended that is at the National Council of Provinces at the moment. And I think it's important that the NSI, together with stakeholders outside government, join hands and just make inputs into these processes and ensure that at least before the end of this year, that this legislation are completed and then everyone focuses on implementation.
You're absolutely right when you say that it's as much about people as it is about policy. How do you inculcate a new ethos of service delivery among civil servants, many of whom would say or feel maybe undermotivated and underpaid?
I think there's a number of things that can be done. Part of the things that can be done is to firstly just continuously engage with the public servants and understand their challenges and be able to work with them from that context of understanding their challenges and work with them around those specific challenges that they are facing. And they will raise a number of challenges with you. Some would relate to the fact that their level of morale is low. They are struggling with tools of trade, those who are in the frontline offices and etc. So we just have to ensure that we engage, we understand, we do the necessary research to deal with those matters. But also the second issue is an ongoing engagement with public servants around working with them to align their own personal values around the values that are in our constitution in respect to the public service. Some of those values, for me, relate to this importance of serving, that it is important for us to instill the culture of serving in public servants so that even the challenges that you experience as a public servant, you should always be in a position that you are able to deliver on your role and responsibilities that you are employed for in the public service. So that's very important. But also putting systems to monitor performance and all those type of things, and improving productivity in the public service, are some of the issues that I think are quite critical.
Just a final question. You will agree with me that corruption does remain a major concern within the civil service. It's a very difficult job to fix accountability within the system. Is that achievable?
Well, I think we can work on it. We can work on it, and I think one of the most important things is to be proactive in fighting corruption in the civil service. What we see now is a reactive approach where mainly there's investigations, there's all these types of things that are being done. I don't have a problem with that, and I support that, but I think we must support that with lots of proactive work, working around values of employees, assisting employees to do lifestyle audits, and to really run campaigns that talks to employees and that reminds them of why they're in the public service. I think there's space to improve a lot.
Thank you very much indeed. That is Yoliswa Makasi, head of the Public Service Reform Program at the NSI, the New South Institute. And that's where we're going to leave it. That's MoneyWeb at midday for today. Join us again tomorrow for more insights shaping the country and the future. Goodbye, and thank you for listening.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday, or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.